And our sermon text today is Revelation 17, 1 to 6. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality, and with the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers on earth have become drunk." And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had seven heads and ten horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her sexual immorality. And on her forehead was written a name of mystery, Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs. There's always been a strong feminine motif in pagan religions. We see that today. We see it in our culture. A tendency to worship a goddess or goddesses as well as a god or gods. That sense of the feminine today is summed up in a figure that we've all become familiar with, Gaia. Merriam-Webster Dictionary of World Religions defines her as the mother of the earth in the great panoply of Greek gods and goddesses. Although she wasn't featured as much in ancient times as she is now, I'm sure we've all heard this name already, right, Gaia? She was nevertheless important to understanding the forces at work in the earth as much as Uranus was for understanding the forces at work in the heavens. That's why she's become the patron saint of the New Age, ecologists and environmentalists. Gaia is composed of two syllables, ge, meaning earth, and aia, meaning grandmother, and is roughly synonymous with Mother Nature. In 1975, Sir James Lovelock, an atmospheric scientist and chemist, published Gaia, A New Look at Life on Earth, in which he posited that the living matter of the planet functioned like a self-regulating organism. The Earth's many different processes, whether geological, chemical, or climatic, interact with each other, forming vital components of the Earth's structure, combining to regulate the Earth. When one system or organism becomes too dominant or destructive of the rest, it is destroyed by the other ecosystems and organisms in combination. This is what is meant by self-regulating. And for many, humanity has become such an organism and is in the process of and must be destroyed. Right? We're a cancer on Gaia, on Mother Earth. But eventually, Gaia will rule. Gaia will overcome. Gaia will impose her will on mankind, just like the Whore of Babylon imposed her will on the Roman Empire. She is not as kind and benevolent, Gaia, as made sound to be by her apologists. Nor are her minions as kind and benevolent. Babylon had a similar goddess. A lot of these things have different names, but same characteristics. Babylon had a similar goddess, Ishtar. She was a fertility goddess, and thus the goddess of sexual love, and importantly, she was the patron goddess of prostitutes. When Babylon flourished, Ishtar smiled upon them. She was smiling upon them. And when Babylon experienced defeat in war, or maybe famine or pestilence, well then, Ishtar was obviously frowning upon them. She was also the goddess of war, giving Babylon her victories, punishing her enemies, persecuting her enemies. And behind her, Babylon became the head of gold in Daniel's vision of the earth's empires. And so in emulation of Babylon, many cultures around the world adopted a version of her. Rome, for Rome it was Cybeline, and we'll see more of her as we move through the text. So it is to her, then, that John alludes in our text today, the great whore of Babylon, riding the beast, that is the empire of Rome. There's a consistency in redemptive history in this motif. The names change, the faces change, but the power, the impact of spirit remains the same. The one behind it remains the same. So behold the equivalent to the spirit which possessed Rome. It's present in our day too. Thus we have our title, Babylon/Gaia. Babylon/Gaia. Watch out for her. 2 points I want to make with you from this text today. Number one, encompassing verses 1-3. Babylon, Gaia. The empire may vary, but the spirit with the reins remains the same. The great whore of Babylon who seduces idolatry, seduces us to idolatry. Verses 1-3. I didn't ask him to, but Stuart printed up an outline. He saw that we're at a juncture when an outline is serviceable. And if you haven't, stick this one in your Bible so you've got it handy and we can reference it again. I have looked at literally hundreds of outlines of the book of Revelation. And this one is by far the best, most economical outline that I have ever seen. Helps me comprehend and understand this book like none other. And as you can see from our outline then, we are in a new major section, the Babylon Appendix. The Babylon Appendix. You'll see it encompasses chapters 17 through 19, verse 10. So it's a pretty good swath. In human anatomy, the appendix is a vestigial organ, isn't it? Quite unnecessary to the functioning of the body. Although some biologists are beginning to question that the poisons located are kind of a storage area and are processed later, right? So the appendix is not, but for the sake of argument, the appendix was ostensibly a vestigial organ. We can live without it. But in literature, appendices are often quite necessary to a full understanding of a text. They just may not fit neatly into the otherwise smooth flow of the work, okay? That's the case here. Precisely what's happening here with the Babylon appendix. It is necessary, if you will, to a full understanding of the text. And we'll see this with the Jerusalem appendix, too. You can cast your eyes down the outline. That's coming up, too, in chapters 21, verse 9 through 22.5. And once again, you see the obvious contrast between the whore of Babylon and the bride, right, of Jerusalem. So that's intentional. Two different appendices, right? But the Babylon appendix provides us with some important information that does not fit into the regular flow of the sevens, right? Seven seals, seven trumpets, seven bowls. It will further elaborate upon the who, what, why, where, and when of that empire so intent on eliminating the church. That's why the church would be reading this very carefully, and we should be too. Because once again, what we see in Revelation sets a pattern for the remainder of redemptive history. It's not obsolete. Just because we're talking about Rome in the past or the destruction of Jerusalem. So what, Pastor, right? Well, hey, it sets a pattern for redemptive history. And if we're smart and if we're alert, we'll see that pattern repeating in our own age. Lo and behold. that empire, of course, so intent on eliminating the church was. The Roman Empire, right? And along the way, the Babylon appendix tells us a lot about our own day and circumstances, too. So it opens here with a transitionary figure, one of the seven angels ministering one of the bowls. And so we know that the Babylon appendix will be a corollary to the judgment of the seven bowls. And this angel now acts as a heavenly guide, too. It's one of the features of apocalyptic, right? That there is a heavenly guide that takes us through the visions of heaven, the visions of hell, whatever they might be. So if there's any ambiguity to the symbols, he is there to clarify. And he introduces the theme for the appendix. Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters. Ishtar was the patron goddess of prostitutes, but to the biblical authors, she herself was the great prostitute. She's the primal spirit, that index for Israel of paganism. She's the primal spirit that inhabits pagan empires. She's a prostitute, then, with a double meaning. Number one, she's a prostitute in regards to sexual immorality. Sexual immorality was an integral part of pagan religion. And we saw from our reading from the law today with the Moabites, how they corrupted Israel in the wilderness. Phinehas redeeming himself and redeeming his people with his zeal, right? Because sexual immorality was an integral part of pagan religion. And it always was there to tempt the people of God. But in pagan religions, to ensure that the land would be fertile and productive, temples to goddesses like Ishtar would be staffed with temple prostitutes who would reenact the fertility rites with you, reenact those fertility rites of nature with you on behalf of the goddess for a price. And it's likely that the wife of the prophet Hosea, we read from the book of Hosea today, who was commanded by the Lord in the opening verses of that book to take for himself a wife of whoredom. Gomer was her name. She was probably one of these, a temple prostitute. And so when the angel says that the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality with her, there's a literal quality to it. But there's also a double entendre, a double meaning, because sexual immorality was also a metaphor for idolatry. Israel was betrothed to one husband, Yahweh, as Isaiah puts it, for your maker is your husband. The Lord of hosts is his name. And the Holy One of Israel is your Redeemer, the God of the whole earth, he is called. Right? Isaiah lays it out there for you. So to worship other gods than him was to commit a kind of spiritual adultery. Consequently, Israel is accused of committing whoredom. We saw that today in our reading from Hosea 4. Hosea says it very explicitly. My people inquire of a piece of wood, and their walking staff gives them oracles, for a spirit of whoredom has led them astray, and they have left their God to play the whore. Spirit of whoredom. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about the great whore of Babylon, the prostitute of Babylon, that spirit of whoredom that invests the hearts and minds of people, right? And I submit to you is investing the hearts and minds of people today too. Not just sexual immorality and debauchery that we see rife around us with the breakdown of genders and whatever it might be in our culture. That's already well established. People just don't realize that it also participates in idolatry as well. It's the same sense here in Revelation. So in other words, the same kings of the earth, that is the Roman emperors and all those other subordinate princes subject to the emperor. They participate freely in the sexual rites of pagan Rome, but also practice idolatry, primarily in worshiping the emperor as divine, not to mention the 1,001 other pagan religions that infested the empire. Our brothers and sisters in that first century were surrounded by such. We haven't been. We've had the privilege, have we not, of centuries, millennia of Christian culture that have pruned all of that away and all the ill effects, the demonic effects. But not much longer if we don't act to stop it. Rome was suffused with these things as just one small slice of life in this regard. The Roman poet Juvenal, and he has written, you read Juvenal and you see just how corrupt and debauched Rome was. Juvenal tells of the very Roman empress Messalina, who, not being satisfied with the loose lifestyle of the Roman court, she would go and serve from time to time in the public brothels of the city, the very empress. Tacitus describes Rome as the place where all the horrible and shameful things in the world congregate and find a home. Seneca, who like Tacitus was an old school Roman patrician, he was a writer and philosopher, he calls Rome a filthy sewer. So, not only was this characteristic of the kings, but constituted the baseline spirituality for the entire Roman world. The wine of whose, right, as verse 2 says, the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers on earth have become drunk. The peoples of the world had all succumbed to the hypnotizing siren song of Rome's power and culture and religion, just like all the world seeks after America and her culture, her music, her food, her movies, whatever it might be. There was that same kind of appetite for all things Roman. Worship any other god of your liking. Just make sure, there was plenty of tolerance in those days. Just make sure you acknowledge Caesar as divine and supreme, right? Caesar is Lord. Robin Lane Fox wrote a book 20 years ago now, Pagans and Christians, a book about how over the centuries, those early centuries, Christianity supplanted pagan Roman culture and how it did it. And he would describe that in the populace, right, those that had bought Roman culture and ways of life, he would say, in this populace, crowded the crowded cities of Asia Minor. That's what he looked at. One couldn't cross a street corner or a city square without encountering a countless myriad of altars and temples and sanctuaries and devotionals to all the gods of the East. It was a carnival of carnality. I like that phrase. A carnival of carnality. Some were expensive and magnificent and grand, but most were just humble and gaudy and fleeting. They were there today and gone tomorrow. But they all have this one thing in common. Their reign is held by the great whore, the spirit of Babylon, now possessing Rome. So now then, with this creature clearly in our sights, John is carried away in the spirit as the vehicle of apocalyptic now to the standard venue of judgment, a wilderness. Not promising for those being judged. In this case, our great whore. Israel was judged in wilderness for 40 years, wasn't she? As Hebrews puts it, their bodies falling all along the way to where none except Joshua and Caleb, not even Moses of that first generation, entered the promised land. And this whore of Babylon sits astride a beast that's reminiscent of the red dragon of chapter 12. One with seven heads and ten horns. And there, of course, in chapter 12, that dragon was Satan. And here, a scarlet beast differs, but is still evocative, meant to be evocative of its satanic inspiration and association. So Gaia and Ishtar and the whore of Babylon, who indeed is the spirit of all of these empires and empires to come if their time remains. This is what is consistent, the satanic inspiration and association. So this is no mild, Gaia is no mild, objective, harmless kind of thing that our greeny friends, these poor, ineffectual hippies, are following, right? No, there is indeed the great whore of Babylon lurking behind all of these power images. She's in control. Whatever the beast is, wherever in history, it is directed by this great prostitute and what she represents. It's covered with blasphemous names, that is, those titles appropriated by Nero to himself, which Christians were reserving for God. That is Theos. We see this in the coinage. We see this in the statuary all through Rome to Nero. Called himself Theos, that is divine, Soter, that is Savior, or Kairos, meaning Lord. These blasphemous names. And for this, the beast and that which dug her spurs into its side, led by reins, would be destroyed utterly. Now, as I prepare for the 4th of July, I'll be comparing two 13s, Romans 13 and Revelation 13. Both are for the church. When it comes to the state and the government, right, it's always Romans 13. We got to submit, right? Romans 13. Revelation 13 is also in the Bible and counsels us to other things, to other responses to the state when it indeed becomes tyrannical. We see this all through Revelation. There are no shades of gray in the apocalypse. There is no submission. Rome and all associated with her are evil to the core. There's no sense here, as in Paul, that Rome was a terror to bad conduct and not to good conduct, or that she is a servant of God who carries out wrath on the wrongdoer. No, in fact, as we have seen and will continue to see, at this stage, Rome was carrying out wrath on those who did good, the saints. No shades of gray in the apocalypse. That brings us then to point two, verses 4-6. Babylon/Gaia. The empire may vary, but the outcome for the saints remains the same. Right? Wherever she makes her appearance, there's persecution of the church. The martyrdom of the saints of Jesus. The outcome always seems, doesn't it, to be martyrdom for the saints. Whether it's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, whether it's Esther and Israel and so forth, it always seems to be the outcome for the saints remains the same. Well, the portrait in verses 4-6, the portrait of this great whore is fleshed out for us, so to speak, if I can use that term. Her decadent luxury is shown by her array, purple and scarlet, both colors that are difficult and expensive to extract. For example, purple is extracted in a very time-consuming process from shellfish. You have to have buckets of shellfish just to get a few ounces of purple. Lydia was a seller of purple. a merchant of this expensive dye, and thus she was probably wealthy. Seems to be indicated so in Acts, right? Yet also, she was also deeply ensnared, that is, prior to her conversion, she was also deeply ensnared in all that surrounded her craft. We've seen this especially in the letters, right? Remember this from the letters, the culture of the guilds, her membership in the merchant guild, and all of the rites and rituals that were practiced by the guild as part of the lifestyle of a merchant. Mercury was the patron god of merchants, and so it was her, that god that she paid obeisance to before becoming a Christian, and she was expected to worship him and go to the barbecues and the parties for him and do all the things that Mercury demanded of his devotees. And if you didn't do this, well, just don't expect much business to come your way. You'll be shunned, yea, eventually persecuted for your neglect of him and for your life being shunned from the life of the merchant guild. Further decadence then is indicated here as well by the gold, jewels, and pearls with which she is adorned. A sign of ostentation, condemned, of course, by the simplicity of the Christian lifestyle, where the Apostle Peter exhorts women, but let your adorning, very same word used here, let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which in God's sight is very precious. The Puritans got this well, and before it became a sign of ostentation, the capacity of the human corrupt heart to make simplicity and purity a sign of ostentation, right, and pride. But that happened too sometimes in Puritan circles. But at least they got that right initially. And now this whore Babylon is ready to toast her lifestyle as well with her golden cup. The golden cup, renowned at banquets, wasn't it? Whether in Daniel or in Esther, this golden cup full of what? Full of a fine French burgundy? Maybe a single malt scotch? Or even fresh, sweet goat's milk from Debbie's farm? Is that what's in this golden cup? No. Abominations and impurities of her sexual immorality. Once more, playing on that double meaning of both debauchery and idolatry. There's an allusion here to the Ishtar Gaia motif too, the Roman variation. There's a Roman variation on the ancient Babylonian goddess Ishtar. Each culture would adopt the panoply of gods and goddesses of other religions and cultures for their own, sometimes giving them different names. And Ishtar, in the Roman panoply of gods, was named Cybele. And Cybele got a full head of steam as a cult in Rome in the early 3rd century BC. But by the time John was writing, it had descended even more debauched than what it was coming over from Babylon into a kind of weird cult of orgy, where the more you partied, the more you showed devotion to her. And so you have both of these double meanings present in the worship of the Roman goddess Cybele. So transparent was this ownership by the spirit of Babylon, owning its devotees, that it is as if it is written in bold letters on her forehead. Remember the symbolic nature of the forehead and the hands, right? Marks of the beast. Here this beast is marked. Babylon the Great, so evident in the life and culture of Rome. Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations. Behold the spirit of idolatry and decadence. which possessed Rome. But not meant to stop here. Indeed, characteristic of like empires throughout redemptive history. Every empire that aspires to the kind of power offered to our Lord by none other than Satan himself, he says to him, to you I will give all this authority and their glory, that is, all the kingdoms of the world. For it has been delivered to me, and I give it to whom I will. If you then will worship me, it will all be yours. Right? The spirit of Babylon, the spirit of whoredom, that is idolatry and decadence and debauchery. That is indeed who is behind cultures, empires with these characteristics, with these aspirations. And what one has not had these aspirations. It doesn't speak to Rome alone. We can't just put this down and say it's a nice academic exercise to take apart the book of Revelation and then walk away as if it has no application and no meaning for us today. Because it indeed is we have seen a repetitive pattern throughout redemptive history. It's a pattern of how tyranny operates throughout redemptive history and has characterized empires since. And as we have seen since chapter 13, it is Satan who is ultimately behind inspiring the spirit of Babylon. That will become even more transparent as we go through. Empires like the medieval papacy, the medieval papacy, those that aspire to go back to Rome, to go back to the Roman Catholic Church with all her enticements. The medieval papacy was indeed infused with this. It's no coincidence that Luther and the reformers identified the Pope and the papacy as the Antichrist, because it was indeed very much so, and argument can be made still very much is. It manifests this same spirit of idolatry and debauchery. Just read Luther's naive journey to Rome as a young priest, where he was disillusioned as to the debauchery and idolatry of Rome. Or the caliphate of Islam. Islam aspires to be master of the world, has come close on several occasions, may come close again. Muhammad has been identified on more than one occasion as the Antichrist. And ironically, although claiming to be rigorously monotheistic, more rigorously monotheistic than Judaism or Christianity, nevertheless, because it is pagan at its heart, Islam cannot help but manifest the same spirit of idolatry and debauchery. Allah, indeed, was one of 65 pagan gods in the panoply of Muhammad's tribe, the Quraysh. But he was the moon god that Muhammad isolated and elevated to the status of the only god, as mocking Christianity, really, in the end, mocking Christianity and Judaism by doing so. So it cannot help but participate in the same spirit of idolatry and debauchery. And tell me the Muslim attitude towards women is not debauched, right, and corrupt. The caliphate of Islam also participates in the spirit of the whore of Babylon, or the British Empire, too. She aspired to rule the world, the sun never setting upon her empire. And for models of idolatry and debauchery, just peel away the layers of the British royalty, and I'll leave that to your own investigations. And of course, we would be remiss in not identifying the 800-pound beast in the room, too, our own beloved deep state, right? We finally got a tag, a name for that to help identify and thus see clearly, more clearly, what we're talking about. Nobody's brought out the nature of the deep state like Donald Trump. Whatever else he's accomplished, he's sure shown us the deep state in its ugliness. And with medical tyranny swiftly descending on us, we've got the predictable second wave that will provide, oh, we're going to have to shut down again, right? Or the mandated masks, the mandated vaccines that are coming. With all of this, the mask is off on tyranny, so to speak. I hope you can see this. I hope you're not just sitting there poo-pooing and say, oh, there he goes again, conspiracy theories, and so forth, right? Chaos in our streets will only continue and will intensify, crescendoing at the time of the presidential elections. You don't have to be a prophet or the son of a prophet to see this coming. If you know your history, pick up a history book and read it, because it's a favored tactic of the Marxist and Leninist revolutions all over the world. The same thing has been practiced very successfully by Marxist Leninists in history past. The history of the 20th century is a history of this. And it's happening in our streets, and people are, oh, it's just those hippies that are throwing up a little resistance. They're just having a little fun. It'll all calm down after a while. And the two-tiered system of privilege and justice will continue to crush us until the middle class disappears. How many businesses have gone up to a third of small businesses, restaurants and so forth, the backbone of America have disappeared just in the first shutdown, right? Crushing the middle class. That's what Marxist-Leninists are also intent on doing. Read the Communist Manifesto. That is one of the planks of the Communist Manifesto. Crushing the middle class until we disappear and what remains is justice, so-called, for the vast sea of the now impoverished proletariat. And another level of privilege for just us. Not justice, but just us, your rulers. Animal Farm, the pigs, right? They were just, all were equal, but the pigs were just a little more equal than the other animals in the farmyard. And I would submit to you, just around the corner is the inebriated beast, this 800-pound beast in the room, the deep state of America. Just around the corner is the inebriated beast, drunk with the blood of the saints, martyrs of Jesus. It was on the menu in Rome, and it's a part of every one of the seven courses of tyranny ready to be served in the near future. Do you really think that churches were categorized as non-essential and forbidden from worship for your health and well-being? If that was the case, if that was really the concern, then they would have shut down the protest. They would have shut down the funeral for George Floyd. You would have seen those riots shut down like that in these blue cities, if indeed that was the case. But they're going to make sure that you have your mask on, right? When government can't control the lawbreakers, it will micromanage the law keepers. When government cannot manage the lawbreakers, it will micromanage the law keepers. And we see that opening up and transpiring before our eyes. So the beast is alive and well. The whore of Babylon is alive and well in the deep state of America. Babylon and Gaia, they have a lot in common. And she will have her will if we let her, especially if the church, who has the responsibility, our founding fathers gave indeed the church implicit responsibilities. As goes the church, so goes the nation. And if we're going to be supine, if we're going to be pusillanimous Presbyterians, then we will indeed see the deep state triumph and continue to triumph. Babylon and Gaia, the whore of Babylon and Gaia, have a lot in common. The names may be different, but indeed the impacts, the effects are very much the same. We see modeled in Rome the deep state of America. And hopefully we have a better response from the church than we have seen thus far. But in order to that, let us now come to that place where we participate in the body and blood of one who sacrificed himself on our behalf. The whore of Babylon may quaff the blood of the saints, but we will indeed quaff the body and blood of that one who sacrificed himself on our behalf so that our deaths would not be in vain. That is, the body and blood of Christ and the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.